and our 3CL seminar. Dealing with AI and neutrality. This is something that Ryan had a lot more about. It's a great pleasure, Ryan, to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for coming to Cambridge. Ryan Abbott is a professor of law and health services, health sciences, at the School of Law, University of Surrey, and assistant professor of medicine at UCLA. So he told me he could still get your prescription for antibiotics or something if you happen to be in LA. And you can tell us more about whether if we have a headache or a broken leg, whether we can also come to you, Ryan. He is, being a physician and a patent attorney, Ryan's research on law and technology engages in international dialogue on these topics. He has served as an expert for the World Health Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization, the European Commission, and the UK Parliament. And he is spearheading, or has spearheaded, depending on where you are in the process, the first patent applications to disclose inventions made by AI only. He has a book coming out called The Reasonable Robot that will be published with CUP this year, and I believe upstairs, probably on the table, we'll have some flyers for that. Ryan, thanks a lot for coming here to Cambridge, and I'm very much looking forward to your seminar.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for coming. So I'm going to be discussing a principle of AI legal neutrality, which is part of my forthcoming book. And it's something to deal with advances in AI that are going to prove disruptive to our current legal systems. I think that AI and board games are a great way of thinking about what AI is going to do to the law. So some of you may have heard back in 2017, DeepMind, which is owned by Alphabet, made an AI system called AlphaGo, which beat the world's leading Go champion. Some experts had thought this would take another decade because of the complexity of Go. There's more board configurations in Go than there are atoms in the universe. But Go was the last board game at which people could outcompete machines. So there's now an entire field of activity at which machines dramatically surpass people. And the impact of that has been limited because board games aren't the world's most practical sort of thing. But it's been one of the oldest tests of machine intelligence and suggests that they may start doing more practical stuff sooner than expected, and perhaps in ways that also dramatically surpass people. It's important that the law help us to realize the benefits of this because, you know, an AI that outperforms people at Go may do a better job of driving a car than a person or a better job than a doctor reading an x-ray. And also that it minimize the risks associated with AI, which are also significant. It's been used for social and political manipulation and caused market flash crashes. And people like Elon Musk even think it's going to doom the human race, or might. But there's a lot less consensus about what the law should do with AI than the risks and benefits posed by AI. And jurisdictions are still very much kind of trying to figure out what they should do, whether people can own data that's useful for AI, whether it can be used to automate decision-making for criminal sentencing or credit rejections and so forth. And in part, some of the hesitancy of accepting AI-centric laws has been a concern that we don't want to slow innovation or get in the way of AI. But really, AI is already regulated just according to laws that were designed to regulate standards of human behavior in things like tort and tax and intellectual property. Sometimes when people start or machines start behaving like people, the standards that we already have result in unexpected and negative outcomes about them. So my thesis is that the law should tend not to discriminate between AI and human behavior, and that this will help the law to better achieve its underlying goals. Because right now we have a system that treats differently behavior by a person and behavior by a machine. So a machine may do a better job of driving a car, but laws may prohibit driverless vehicles. A person may provide customer service better than a machine, but businesses may automate to save on taxes. A machine may do a better job of inventing things, but IP laws may prohibit protections for AI-generated inventions. And in all of these areas, more legal neutral treatment would improve social outcomes. Of course, AI can behave like a person, but AI is not like a person. So you wouldn't treat them exactly the same legally. I think the prime example of this being that AI does not deserve rights. It doesn't have human-like interests or consciousness. So if we were able ever to give an AI a legal right, it would be solely because we think this would improve human well-being, the way we give companies legal rights. Companies don't have legal rights because they're morally deserving of them, but because we think it helps people engage in entrepreneurship and commerce in ways that increase wealth for people. So this isn't to say that machines deserve rights. It isn't to say that machines should have legal personhood of some sort. It's just to say that treating machine and human behavior the same way will tend to produce better outcomes. So I talk about this in four areas in the book, and I'm going to skip criminal law because I've only got 30 minutes, and just go right into the sexiest legal subject there is, tax law. And we're getting a whole lot of scholarship now on AI and the future of work, which tends to go one of two ways. Either AI is dramatically improving and people aren't, and there's a limited number of things people do, and sooner or later, AI is going to be doing all of these things, and people are going to be just out unemployed, right? Once they take over driving cars, 3% of the population that works in transportation is suddenly going to be jobless, and what are we going to do about that? The other vein of scholarship says, people have been saying that since the first Industrial Revolution. Actually, unemployment's at all-time lows. We find new jobs for people once machines start taking these sorts of things over. Either way, the machines are going to be really disruptive. Either we get widespread unemployment or we get significant short-term disruptions where truck drivers have to find new jobs and we need to do something about that. Or in the first Industrial Revolution, they just sort of let them deal with it on their own and it didn't end that well. One of the things that hasn't been appreciated in this debate is the role of taxes in this, because the law treats differently labor by a person and work by a machine. So for example, McDonald's has automated tellers here in this country, and if you can get an automated teller to do the same work as a human teller, McDonald's doesn't have to make national insurance contributions for that teller, right? So human labor has this additional surcharge placed on it that machines don't, which means that even if a machine isn't quite as effective, it may have a tax savings on top of that. That's kind of the simplest example, but there are a number of ways in which the law treats capital and labor work differently. So you can accelerate deductions for capital investments, but not for people. So if you buy that automated teller, McDonald's can claim a large portion of it upfront as a tax benefit and use that. It has a present value because large companies have cash reserves, and this deduction has more value than the upfront cash expense. And they're not thought to bear the incidence of indirect taxes on workers. So without getting too into tax, the point is that you have capital equipment and human workers doing the same sorts of things but subject to different tax regimes in ways that inefficiently subsidize automation. And what's even worse is that robots don't pay taxes, which sounds kind of ridiculous until you think that, I've mainly looked at this on the US side, 85% plus of federal tax revenue comes from labor taxes. About 35% from payroll taxes, which is basically national insurance contributions, Social Security and Medicaid, and then the rest from income taxes. Statutory tax rates are falling. In the US, corporate taxes make up about 8% of tax revenue. So when a business automates, they pay no payroll taxes on the AI. The AI doesn't pay income taxes, and it's not out renting space or buying things, so it's not paying VAT or sales taxes. It's not paying property taxes. An AI is nothing like a person in terms of paying taxes. And so not only are we incentivizing automation with tax without really meaning to, but we're robbing ourselves of tax revenue at the same time. In the long term, if everyone rendered unemployed finds new, better paying work, that may balance out. But you're likely to have a short-term problem re-educating people. And if you do have a long-term unemployment situation, you're really going to have a lot less revenue, which is problematic because the two things that are widely regarded to be the solution to widespread automation are investing in worker education and social benefits. And this means we may have less revenue for that. So how should the law deal with something like that? Well, I think that it should level the playing field in terms of tax between work done by a person and work done by a machine. And there's a lot of solutions, but I think the best option may just be to do away with payroll taxes, which is to say no more national insurance contributions. It makes it more appealing to employers to hire people. There's less tax on labor, And then businesses will be inclined to automate if it is legitimately more efficient and not for tax reasons. Of course, that deprives a lot of revenue, so we'd have to find a new way to make up for something like that. And we could do this by increasing VAT or property taxes or having higher progressive income rates. I think a better solution, though, might be to increase corporate and capital taxation, because AI is going to result in a lot more wealth that is almost certain to be more unequally distributed. And as one of our goals with automation should be to share the value of this more widely, I think that increasing capital and corporate taxation is justified for this and will help everyone share in the benefits of AI. And if we do head towards a future with widespread automation to a world with basic income where everyone receives money from the government to regardless of their condition. So that's a bit on taxes, but AI isn't just automating tellers. It's automating all sorts of things people used to do, like driving vehicles, which means they're going to start causing injuries to people. And once again, in the law, we have different treatment of accidents caused by machines and accidents caused by people. So if I run you over with my car, we generally hold me to a negligence standard and say, would a reasonable driver have caused that accident? If yes, I'm not liable. If no, then I am liable. But with machines, with product liability, we generally hold them to a strict liability standard. We say, regardless of social blameworthiness, did a machine cause an accident? Did it have a defective design? If yes, then liable. If no, then not. Or was it defectively marketed? And this is a higher liability standard because it doesn't require negligence. Well, sometimes that's a good rule. It's historically been a good rule for products because it incentivizes manufacturers to make safer products. But it can be a less good rule when the machines are safer than we are. Because once the machines are safer than we are, you'd be better off automating for safety, even if the machine isn't perfect. Indeed, we've already had at least one fatality caused by a self-driving car, and there's a lot of public concern about people getting behind the wheel of a self-driving car, or people not driving other people around. And yet, almost all auto fatalities are caused by people. People are actually terrible drivers. A million people a year are killed in auto accidents, 94% of which are due to human error. So the self-driving cars don't have to be perfect to make us safer, just a little bit better than people, and that's actually a pretty low bar. And if we hold them to a higher liability standard than people, people are less likely to want to automate if it has more liability associated with it. So I think that the solution to this problem is to hold self-driving cars to a negligence standard when they have caused an accident, or rather to hold their suppliers liable to a negligence standard. So if you have a self-driving car that runs a red light and hits someone, we don't say, did the car have a defect? Was it defectively designed? We just say, would a reasonable human driver run a red light and hit a pedestrian? And if the answer is no, then the manufacturer is liable. And if the answer is yes, then it's not. This would have another benefit too, because these cars are increasingly complex and difficult to evaluate for decision making. So it could be hard to say, well, why did a car run a red light? Usually, despite people claiming these are black boxes, sometimes you can figure it out, but it's very resource intensive, which puts it out of the range of the standard sorts of accidents. And there's issues with trade secrecy and disclosure of confidential algorithms. So instead of having to get into a computer's programming to search for a defect, you just focus on its activity and ask, is that negligent sort of activity? But I think actually this is the less important part of the story, although it's something people are really worried about. Who or what's going to be liable for an accident caused by a self-driving car? I think two things. One, you've already seen this and they've been paid out very quickly. These are all commercial products. Manufacturers are liable for them and have a lot of incentive to quickly pay them out. So I don't think people aren't going to get compensated from it. And if you ever, it's not clear you'd ever really have a totally autonomous self-driving car that wasn't a commercial product, because who would benefit from putting that into service? But if you ever did, you could have a compulsory insurance regime or something like that. I think the much more interesting point about this is that not only are self-driving cars going to be safer than we are, but they're going to be much safer than we are, to the point where they may almost never cause accidents. And at that point, the real danger on the road isn't going to be the self-driving cars, but the people. And so the same way that I think a machine doing a human-like activity should be held to a human standard, I think that a person doing an automatable activity should be held to a machine standard. And we should say, well, I ran you over with my car, but would a self-driving car have run you over? And if the answer is yes, then I wouldn't be liable. And if the answer is no, then I would be liable. I, you know, as soon as it's practical to automate, right? So if you could only buy a self-driving car for £1 billion, that wouldn't work. But if, you know, I can go to an auto dealership and the self-driving cars are about the same price, right? But I choose to drive because I like freedom and autonomy and I like driving, but I'm not a very safe driver. That internalizes the risk of the accident on me. So it's saying, you know, your best human effort isn't enough anymore to prevent an accident. But it's also saying, but you should have more concern for your fellow pedestrians and maybe you just shouldn't be driving at all, right? That's the rationale we have now for people who have kind of below average driving skills. We don't hold them to a separate standard. We hold them to the standard of an average person and say, well, if you fall beneath those capabilities, it's unfortunate for you, but it wouldn't be fair to everyone else to say, well, you get to be a bad driver because you're just not a very good driver, right? So if a self-driving car wouldn't have caused an accident, a person would be liable. And ultimately what this means is that a self-driving car would be held to the standard of another self-driving car once it sets the baseline standard of care. And so we would say of a self-driving Tesla car, you know, would a self-driving Google car have caused this accident? Once we live in a world where drivers are primarily self-driving cars. And not just in the self-driving car context, but machines are going to be doing all sorts of things that only people used to do. This is a Da Vinci robot slicing up a ham sandwich. So now we go to a doctor, and medical error, by the way, is a leading cause of death, which we are working on, but is hard to get away from and hard to minimize. You know, we have human doctors looking at radiographs and doing surgeries. And the time not may not be far from now when a robot surgeon does a significantly better job of surgery than a human surgeon. And you might say at that point, well, you know, instead of holding the human doctor liable for medical malpractice based on the human standard of care, we say, well, what would the robot surgeon have done? Because if the human doctor has an 80% chance of a positive outcome and the robot surgeon has a 95% chance of a positive outcome, it's not clear that we should be really using a human surgeon at all. And at some point that it might be unethical for human doctors to continue to do these sorts of things once machines do a much better job. That's a bit on tort, but AI won't just be doing work, causing injuries, and committing crimes, which we're not going to talk about. It'll be inventing new stuff. So this is a picture of IBM's Watson avatar, which won a game of Jeopardy in 2011, which is like ancient history now in AI terms. Watson's now a brand that has a whole bunch of different AI in it. And one of their business models is called the Insights business model. And big clients give data to IBM. IBM runs the data through this host of algorithms. The algorithms produce insights that it picks up from the big data. The insights belong by contract to the client, and the client can patent these. Well, what's interesting in patent law is traditionally it's required a human inventor. Someone who, in their head, has the complete idea of an invention and all of the claimed features of it. But it's not clear in that scenario who an inventor would be. So you're not an inventor by commissioning research or by asking for a known problem to be solved. Maybe someone who programs Watson's an inventor, but not if they don't know the problem it's solving or the solution it generates, and not if hundreds or thousands of people program Watson. Maybe the person who looks at what Watson comes up with and says, oh, that's patentable, that might be an inventor, especially if Watson says, well, here's 15 examples, go pick the best one. But if Watson says, you know, drug X also treats condition Y, there's no inventive skill required to determine that that should be patentable. And so there doesn't going to be any basis for someone qualifying as an inventor there. So at least some of the time with AI involved in invention, we don't have a traditional human inventor. And this raises some really interesting questions about IP law generally, but particularly with patents, namely, can you protect this stuff at all? Who or what should be listed as an inventor? And who or what should own these things? So I spearheaded an effort which we announced last year for two inventions made autonomously by an artificial intelligence without a person who traditionally qualifies as an inventor. We filed these at the UK and EPO patent offices. They both said these are patentable inventions. We then corrected inventorship and said, oh, by the way, there's no human inventor, there's a machine. And both have just been rejected, and both are getting appeal. And these are now pending applications in a bunch of jurisdictions around the world. It's interesting because, you know, these rules designed to have human inventors came from a time before people were thinking, how could you have an invention without a human inventor? But that's more what we have. There is more law on the copyright front. So in 1973, the US Copyright Office decided that if you had something that was made without an actual person as an inventor or as an author, it could not receive protection. The UK went in the other direction. Since 1988, they've had a law for computer-generated works. So if a computer makes something and you don't have a traditional person who qualifies as an author, the producer of the work is deemed the author and owns the right, and it's for a shorter term. The US is citing in support of its policy back to the 1880-something case of Napoleon Cerroni v. Burrough Giles Lithographic Company. That was a case involving a famous picture of Oscar Wilde, where a lithographic company reproduced the picture and said, you can't own copyright in the photograph. It's just a natural reproduction of a natural phenomenon. So the case was about whether or not using a camera would negate authorship, or whether a camera could be an author to some extent. And the court there said, really any creative mental activity by someone should be protectable. And so that case held both photographs are protected, and the Copyright Office is essentially saying now, well, there's nothing kind of mentally creative going on when a machine makes something that would otherwise get copyright, so we're not going to protect it. This standard was challenged in the monkey selfies case. So a crested macaque named Naruto in Indonesia took its own picture using a camera belonging to a UK nature photographer, David Slater. The story changed a little bit and eventually ended up with him saying he left the cameras out and enticed the monkey to come take its own picture. You know, in an early version, the monkey just picked up the camera, took its own picture. It is not smiling at you. This is an aggressive display. It is looking at its own image and thinking, I don't like that monkey. Stay away from me. Some people use this picture without Mr. Slater's permission. He threatened to sue them. And there was so much public discussion over this. The Copyright Office updated its human authorship requirements and said, pictures taken by monkeys don't qualify for copyright. That seemed to let the issue die down until PETA sued on behalf of the monkey in California, alleging that the monkey should own the copyright and PETA would administer it. That case was dismissed, but dismissed on standing. The court said Congress has to authorize monkeys to sue if we're going to let monkeys sue, and as they have not done that, you can't bring this case. So the merits of this policy have never been challenged, but the Copyright Office and the U.S. Patent Office are revisiting their policies for this sort of thing. There's really never been any case on them at all. I argue that we ought to protect these inventions, and the reason for that is based on the underlying premise of why in England and the U.K. we have a patent system which is primarily to be an economic incentive for innovation, right? We think that by letting people get patents, they'll be more encouraged to innovate, and all of society will benefit. And even though machines don't care about patents, people who build and use and own machines do care about patents. And if we allow their output to get protected the same way as a person's, we'll be encouraging companies like IBM and DeepMind to build inventive AI. And that is going to result in more innovation for everyone. You know, similarly, when a machine invents, I think that we should list the machine as the inventor, not as a matter of rights to machines, but because it is factually accurate, and it will keep people from claiming credit for work they haven't done, right? Which wouldn't be unfair to a machine, but it would be unfair to other human inventors because it would change what it means to be an inventor. It would mean that I can just ask Watson to invent 1,000 things and put my name down, and then someone in Cambridge Laboratory is doing their PhD for a decade, you know, is on the same footing as me. You know, who would own a patent? Clearly not an AI. That wouldn't make sense for all sorts of reasons. The AI's owner would own its patent. The same way that if an AI you own makes a trade secret, you own that trade secret. If you own a machine that bakes bread, you own the bread that comes out of it, absent complex relationships you may have with other people and machines. You know, as an interesting matter in these UK and EPO appeals, the EPO may not even have jurisdiction to discuss the issue of who or what qualifies as an inventor, There's a couple jurisdictions that don't require a natural person to be an inventor, a couple jurisdictions that don't require disclosure of an inventor, and even in the UK, your only obligation may be to report who the inventor is and the actual deviser of the invention. So we reported the machine devised the invention and that no one is the natural person who invented it. And that might be all that's required. AI is going to change all sorts of things about patent law. You know, and one of the exciting things about AI and the law is that not only is AI going to be competitive with us, but at some point dramatically surpassing us, at least in some areas. We have this standard in patent law, much like the reasonable person in tort law, called the person having skill in the art. And this is the standard used to test when something should get a patent. If your skilled person, who essentially represents an average researcher in a scientific field, would find a patent application non-obvious, it can get a patent. If they say, oh, this is an obvious development over the prior art, you cannot get a patent. So again, it represents the skilled person who might be a chemist at Pfizer or just someone out on the street if it's a sort of simple everyday invention. I picked a picture of London commuters to represent the average researcher, and this is the happiest looking picture of London commuters I could find. You probably can't tell from where you are, but they look pretty unhappy. So this standard should change as AI gets more and more involved in the process, because even now in some fields, your average researcher is augmented by AI. And this makes them more knowledgeable than they would otherwise be, because there's only so much you can expect an average researcher to know. But with access to machines that are capable of instant recall of superhuman amounts of information, you're expanding the knowledge base of your average researcher, which is one part of the test for what makes something obvious. And the other part is how sophisticated are they? But augmentation with AI is going to make people more sophisticated, because things that used to be very difficult for someone like pattern recognition in a big database may suddenly be trivial. And the really interesting thing is going to happen when you take these inventive machines and they start automating on a widespread basis research and development. When instead of Pfizer going to a team of research scientists and saying, we need to find some new uses for our existing drugs to extend their patent life, they just ask Watson or DeepMind, give it 500 million patient records from a large NHS database and say, find some new uses of our drugs. And the machine spits back, here's a list of 20 things you can patent. Because then the average researcher has essentially become an inventive machine, and then the question would be as to whether or not you should get a patent. Would an inventive machine find this obvious or not? Which might result in us needing to change the whole test, because it's hard to think, well, what would an inventive machine find obvious? But you know, it may not be a great test right now asking what would a person find obvious. There's a lot of hindsight bias in it. So it might be better to have more of an economic test where we say, well, how was an invention received by the marketplace? Was there concurrent invention? Was there a long-felt need for this? Was there professional skepticism it could be done? And so forth. This is also going to really change or challenge humans being involved in this process. So with biological drugs, which are drugs made from biological rather than chemical processes, like Humira is the biggest selling one, they're all monoclonal antibodies. So your body makes antibodies, and it does these in a complex way that generates them in response to potential pathogens your body wants to fight off. One of the interesting things about it from a computer perspective is that there's a finite number. So you can make at least billions of antibodies and maybe trillions, and that's enough for your body to do everything it really needs to do with them. But they're basically just strings of amino acids, and they're not that big. And there's only so many possible combinations of amino acids you can. And for human researchers, that might not be a problem, but for a machine, it's not that hard to imagine that it could sequence every possible antibody, maybe even right now. Like, here's the 50 billion possible antibodies you could make. And if it published that online, that might keep anyone from getting a patent on a monoclonal antibody. And patents on monoclonal antibodies are the foundation of all drug portfolios for biological drugs. You couldn't get a patent yourself on that without knowing its usefulness, because that's one of the other requirements for patent. But machines can also now do a fair job of sequencing what antibodies will target what antigens, which are the target you want it to apply to, and how will these things behave in people. They're not perfect at it, but they're getting better. But, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, you might imagine that a machine could sequence and publish every single antibody with every single use for every antibody. And if you had a cancer, it could sequence your cancer, match it to an antibody from this library, and individually treat your cancer, right? Which on the one hand might give a company like IBM a patent on the cure for cancer, but on the other hand, we'd have the cure for cancer. This phenomenon of machines automating R&D on a widespread basis and becoming more sophisticated than human researchers is going to raise the bar to patentability, because inventive machines will find more obvious than today's skilled researchers. And the bar will just rise and rise and rise if machines can indeed continue to become more sophisticated or improve themselves to become more sophisticated, until at some point, machines or super intelligent machines are so sophisticated that really everything is obvious to them and nothing can get a patent. But that would be fine, because at that point, it would be so trivial for a machine to generate a new invention, you wouldn't really need that same sort of incentive anymore. Now, back to board games. The Go win was a big deal, but so was 1997 IBM's Deep Blue win over Garry Kasparov, something else the critics had thought might never be possible, right? And it teaches us a few other things about it. It teaches, really, AI is an exceptional technology. It's something that autonomously behaves like a person in ways different than its creators would, right? So you could stack up all the programmers who made Deep Blue against Garry Kasparov, and playing together as a team, they would have very quickly lost, right? They really made something that could then go out and have a functionality that they themselves didn't possess. And it also speaks to a near-term future in which it's really going to be more about augmentation than automation. So after he lost, he had a bright idea and thought, okay, so a machine always beats a person, but I bet a machine and a person could do better playing as a team than independently, because grandmasters are really good at thinking far ahead, and machines are really good at calculating millions of moves a second. And indeed, he was right. He won the next year, the first human AI Centaur chess tournament, where a person and a machine play together. Indeed, they beat a person, but they also beat a machine, because the human grandmaster has strengths that the chess machine doesn't. But, you know, that only holds to a point, because the same year of Go's victory, the chess engine Cryptic beat the world's best human plus AI team. And so at some point, people may just get in the way. Thank you.